on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about psychic readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you, or it's give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month. Insight, 11 to midnight.
Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Craig Lang, a certified hypnotherapist, NLP practitioner, researcher, writer, and healer. Craig's website can be found at www.craigrlang.com. Good evening and welcome, everyone. Trish Sheridan speaking. Again, welcome to the August 17th, 2012 edition of A Global Focus with featured guest Craig Lang. The Global Focus program is broadcast on 107.9 FM New Orleans and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Guest details can be found at the show website, aglobalfocus.com. Craig R. Lang is a certified hypnotherapist with the National Guild of Hypnotists and an NLP practitioner, researcher, writer, and healer. He lives and has his hypnotherapy practice in Brooklyn Center, a northern suburb of Minneapolis. Craig works in service to humanity, doing both research and healing work in a variety of areas. Craig conducts hypnotherapy to help people with career, mind, body, and life quality issues. In addition to hypnotherapy, he's a field investigator and researches UFO sightings, anomaly reports, and close encounters. Craig conducts UFO and close encounter research in the Twin Cities metro area of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and in surrounding areas within Minnesota and Wisconsin. Craig has authored two books, The Cosmic Bridge, Close Encounters and Human Destiny, and The Other Side of the Sky, The Cosmic Bridge Companion. Craig Lang's website can be found at www.craigrlang.com. Craig, welcome to the program. Your research articles. What a pleasure. I so admire your research articles and books. They're excellent reads. They're very informative.
Great. Glad to hear they make a good impression here.
They certainly do. Now, Craig, you are very highly credentialed in your hypnotherapy capabilities. Could you describe your practice to us?
Well, I've just gone largely full-time into my business. I do hypnotherapy half-time. I do a lot of work with fear management and stress management. A lot of work, I'm focusing a lot on business and people who are, you know, like entrepreneurs and middle managers and the like that are undergoing a lot of stress. And there's a lot of, you know, having been in that world myself and just having just left that world, I can attest to just exactly how much stress can affect you. And so one of the things I'm looking at doing now is going back into that world and helping other people that have been where I was not that long ago.
That sounds like a wonderful objective. You know, Craig, given the uncertainties in the present economy, there's so many people who need counseling, motivation, and just morale support. They have that career that they hire for which they're aiming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, now, Craig, am I correct that you do have several clients who have experienced UFO sightings and possible ET or other anomalous encounters? Your books present wonderful observations and advice on how experiencers can respond to these events. Craig, you are convinced that experiencers, as well as other citizens, can come to terms with these issues and, in their case, with anomalous events in their lives.
Well, there's a number of different, you know, coming to terms with has a lot of different meanings. You know, first of all, yeah, you've hit the other half of my world. There is, you know, when I talk about the conservative business world, that's when I talk about stress management and healing and mind-body healing work.
Yes.
But the other half of my world is that close encounter research, and the realm of what I call, you know, the realm of the cosmic bridge. And basically, the cosmic bridge, the whole idea behind that title was that I find the experiencer is effectively a bridge between worlds. They tend to be, you know, like Bud Hopkins said, they live 99.9% of their time in this world, and then the other side of it is that other 0.1% of the time that they live in this phenomenal realm. And they sort of feel like they're stuck in between worlds. So one of the things that I find that most of the people have found was that they needed a way to somehow come to terms with that gap, kind of somehow bridge that gap between worlds. And that's hence the title.
That's a great explanation. And, you know, just a brief return to the other segment of your practice, I see here correlations. Both groups, both experiencers and non-experiencers, want to achieve their life goals. They want to find themselves in careers that are fulfilling, that also help them to remain economically independent. So they are really both seeking to maximize their own potential and their own contribution to the community. So there's a definite correlation there. Now, with the cosmic bridge and contact, you give great paradigms for evidentiary markers as well as possible developments in this scenario of contact between humans and non-human entities, in this case, aliens. Now, one event that really floored me, Craig, was the fact that, despite the fact that experiencers and field researchers note this lack of mainstream media interest in the paranormal and UFO and ET fields, that situation seems to be improving. And I noted a great reference in your Cosmic Companion to the fact that in 2003, you gave a presentation at a National Guild of Hypnotists event. You're a member of that association, of course, and you were discussing your regressions on experiencers with close encounters.
Yeah, I gave a talk in both 2003 and in a couple years after that, in about 2000. I can't remember exactly when I did it. I was an adjunct teacher. I can't remember when it was. It was like 2003 and 2005 that I gave talks at the Guild on it was a lecture to other hypnotherapists on how to how to deal with experiencers, because pretty much every hypnotherapist is going to have one or two of these in their career, even if they're not really open to it. Sooner or later, somebody's going to have come out with one of these experiences. It's about 1% of the population of all humanity, roughly, and so it seems to be just by statistics, by hit or miss, 1% of that population, 1% of their clients are at some point going to have that. So it comes out to maybe one or two people in their career, roughly. So it's kind of, how do you deal, or what happens if this person shows up in your office?
And can I ask you a question, too, as well, Craig, regarding the background of the experiencers? Do you find that, indeed, manifest in the full spectrum, that many of them are leading very fulfilling lives, and yet when this contact occurs, have a disruptive or confusing influence?
Yeah, very much. It tends to be pretty much across the board. I've had people from all walks of life, from kind of the hillbilly to people in high up in the business world. I had one CEO who was, pretty sizable company, who was, and then one political figure, and one person who was very highly, worked in very, very highly classified material. So there's a lot of different areas, different walks of life, different beliefs, all the like.
Well, you know, I'm thrilled that someone of your caliber is addressing these issues. You know, well, Frank, can I ask you a question? Do you think that the that your peers, indeed they must be, with the fact that you're presenting those wonderful addresses to the National Guild of Hypnotists, it seems to me that perhaps your peers are becoming a bit more aware, a bit more informed of this issue. Sometimes it can be frightening. You know, I've heard people say that if they hear of someone seeing you, the person should immediately have a brain scan.
Well, I don't think they'd find anything different. I don't think they'd find anything different in the brain scan of anybody who'd seen one, as opposed to anyone who hasn't. Just about 10% of the population has actually seen a UFO, you know, and that of some reasonable level of strangeness, basically, that is reasonably unexplained. Just about everybody has seen something that didn't quite make sense in the sky, but you know, you could probably explain it away, but about 10% or so have seen something that's pretty reasonably unexplained. And so it's pretty hard to say that 10% of all of our population are warped, if you will.
Absolutely. Are you finding as well, Craig, that those individuals who observe these UFO craft in closer proximity are more likely to be experiencers?
Yeah, that's probably... It depends on you. When I hear a close encounter of the first kind, which is an object up close, close enough that you can notice detail, the person has only had one, chances are pretty good that it's probably strictly a close encounter of the first kind. If a person's had multiple close-up sightings in their lives, my antennas go up. I tend to look for, well, are there other aspects of their life, you know, you start to ask a lot of questions about are there paranormal aspects of their life, are there discontinuities in the narrative. There's a lot of questions that you ask, well, you ask them in all cases, but there's a lot of things that tend to show up along with multiple close encounters.
And thank you for that excellent answer. Also, we have a very intriguing question coming in from one of our researchers here. He's also a wonderful artist. His name is Bill. I believe you know him. Also, his question, I think it's very important. He wonders, Craig, have you ever run into cases where someone comes to you concerning missing family members due to contact or a missing 411 situation?
411 meaning
emergency situation.
911
situation. That's what you mean. 911. He might be thinking of another.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have not seen. I have not had any of those cases myself. I have heard from other. You know, I've heard kind of on the grapevine that other people have. But personally, I have not. I've had a couple of people try and hoax me. You know that. I've had a couple of midnight calls from people who were, I think, had a little too much to drink. That, when I get a call from Blocked on Saturday night, Sunday morning at midnight, I tend to be a little discerning about the reality of it. But having said that, I've had a couple of cases that the person, you know, quite a few cases actually where the person genuinely scared. And I don't know what the, you know, and a lot of these have been cases from other parts of the country, and a few of them have been out of the country, and they just have been, the person was scared. Basically, all I can do is really connect them up with someone more local, usually the local MUFON chapter, and that's about the best I can do.
I think that's a wonderful strategy. That's a wonderful choice in there.
Yeah,
you know,
I haven't found any other... Any cases myself, though, where like someone's disappeared or something like that, that's not been my experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, Craig, I also note that your books contain excellent discussions. You also reference the research of other excellent researchers, such as yourself. You note the coining of the term post-contact syndrome by authors, researchers Bryant and Seebach in their book Healing Shattered Reality.
Now,
find that several of the experiencers can exhibit signs of post-contact syndrome given the anomalous environment, the trauma.
Yeah, that's a number of cases. It's really a form of, I'm certified as a hypnotherapist. I'm not licensed as a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, one of the things we are strictly forbidden to do is diagnose. So I can refer to things in a certain way, but I have to be very careful about any established diagnoses. So, but anyway, Bryant and Seebach, unfortunately, they're both passed away now. Linda Seebach was the daughter, I believe, of Bryant. Anyway, she was. Unfortunately, they both passed away. But she did a lot of work with. She's a psychologist and a hypnotherapist that was one of the early pioneers in the area. She did a lot of work with helping people to come to terms with this bizarreness that occurs in their life.
Well, you know, Craig, as well, I thought it was very helpful, your several lists of important findings on the different elements of your research. You list phenomenon indicators that your readers can review to determine if they or someone they know might be experiencing UFO and ET-related events.
Yeah.
If we could just quickly go through them. First of all, missing time.
Yeah, that's pretty classic. This is all... Actually, this is all pretty standard stuff. You see it in, like, the Intruders Foundation, or David Jacobs has UFOabduction.com, I think it is. Very good list of that. I think in the ICAR website there's a pretty good one, too, on kind of surface indicators, if you will.
Yes, indeed. But, missing time, succession of anomalies, sightings, here from your book, Fear, Obsession regarding a particular location.
Yeah.
That's new for me.
Yeah.
That's a new one. I didn't know that. An inexplicable and sudden change in belief systems or behavior, thought patterns, or health situation.
Yeah.
Or experiencing a menacing or mysterious feeling in the middle of night or the night or concerning the sky.
Yeah.
Obsession
and
fear regarding certain topics and sudden appearance of paranormal and or psychic abilities. You know, that's an interesting list. That could produce quite a disruption in anyone's life.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of people that I've worked with that had sudden psychic switch-ons.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there's one woman that I worked with. I call her Susan in the book. That she had a number of cases of things like spontaneous invisibility.
Yes.
She woke up one morning and basically she could read minds just like she could see, you know, anything around you. Yeah, and it's just like, what do you do with that? I mean, basically, when you can't, it's like hearing everybody shouting around you. So it's, how do you turn that off? And so I've worked with several people on that as to how to help them to turn down the volume, if you will, turn down the sensitivity to the point where they can, you know, to get control over those gifts.
That would be excellent advice. And I know later I'd love for you to discuss the research on the different anomaly levels you have discovered, as well as such important phenomena as spontaneous invisibility. Now, Craig, when you meet with your clients on these particular subjects, do you use the neuro-lingual practitioner
NLP,
aspects of that?
NLP.
Oh, thank you. Please give me the correct acronym for that.
It's neurolinguistic. It used to be called neurolinguistics programming. Now it's been kind of rephrased as neurolinguistic psychology because programming sounded kind of mind control-ish, and it's not that at all. But it's what I use that as part of. I generally bury a lot of neurolinguistic language patterns into my hypnosis work.
Yes.
There's a lot of different, there's a series of language patterns called Ericksonian language. There are a number of other things called NLP. There's a number of different techniques that you can use for things like fear management. And there's a lot of very short-term work. It's a very good way of phrasing hypnotic suggestions so that they're extremely effective. Like, for example, there's some techniques in NLP that I use for short-term fear management that are extremely effective.
Well, you know, that sounds to me as though that would be a great modality for helping the experiencers just come to terms.
Mm-hmm.
And to be, you know, and to feel comfortable again with their, you know, their daily routine. Now, let me see here. I've got so many questions. I really do. Now, I actually have tried to go to that spot on spontaneous invisibility.
It's Donna Higby, I think, wrote that material. That's actually a pretty old website. I don't even know if it's still up anymore. I pushed Bridge in about 05, 06.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bridge is actually about 5 or 6 years old now. I'm working on a new book, you know, on it. Tentatively, I'm calling it The Close Encounter Survival Guide, on how to come to terms with, how people come to terms with it, come to terms with close encounters. That's a long ways off. I'm just collecting material for the book now.
Well, I have the opportunity of interviewing you on that book as well. I just found my note. Now, Craig, I have a note here. Spontaneous invisibility, a term you reference as being used by Bud Hopkins and Donna Higby. Now, here is the way I interpret it. Where the experiencer, as he or she goes about their daily routine, and just as they are about to go into an encounter, appears invisible to his fellow humans, and you had a great
seems to be what's happening.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
when you're entering this world, either entering or just coming out of this phenomenal domain, somehow you seem to be not quite in this world, if you will, and other people in this realm sometimes can't perceive you. Mm-hmm. And there are several, you know, Kay Wilson has described that, and Bud Hopkins in his book, I'm having a senior moment on the name.
Is it The Intrusion? Dave, you mentioned several of his works, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Craig, here too, you gave a wonderful account in your Cosmic Bridge regarding one of your clients, an experiencer, who during the height of the UFO and ET encounter scenario was driving the car, and apparently she wasn't visible by other driver traffic. That must have caused quite a commotion.
Yeah, that was a very interesting scenario. You know, it only lasted like a second or two, but, you know, that was the same woman that woke up, basically in the morning, she woke up psychic, extremely psychic, the same woman, I call her Susan in the book. She, when she woke up, you know, but basically on or about that same time, it was like a little before, a little after, somewhere in there, but she was driving down one of your major streets in Minneapolis, and she pulled up to a traffic light. And there was this, and all of a sudden she noticed everybody was looking in the car. And said, hey, there's no one in that car. You know, it was like several people, you know, from the side of the street kind of looked in there. And, you know, it's like there was no one driving the car. And then the light changed, you know, she kind of got weirded by that. And then the light changed and she, like everybody else, she hit the gas and drove on. And it's like nothing, you know, and then you know, within a second, life was back to normal. But there have been a number of those cases where people have been like on the phone or something like that. All of a sudden, the people around them just couldn't perceive them. And like Bud Hopkins, Sight Unseen is the name of the book that I was referring to, by Bud Hopkins. Where he talks about Kay Wilson in a number of cases. I think she went by Katerina at that time. But she, you know, she had a case where she had just come back from some kind of an anomaly or some kind of a abduction experience, and she was in the ladies' room. I don't know if that's where she was returned or if that she left or she entered a ladies' room just afterwards, but she couldn't get the infrared sensors in her, you know, by passing her hand under it, she couldn't get the hand dryer to start up, things like that. I don't know whether she was actually able to grip the water faucet or anything like that. And it doesn't last very long, but still there's this, it's sort of like being stuck between worlds in a way.
Boy, that's beautifully described, Craig. And, you know, that references to me your mention of a dual physical-mental reality.
Yeah.
That's very intriguing. And perhaps it also suggests as well other dimensions.
I don't think we even begin to understand what the physics of this is. To my way of thinking, when we do figure this out, it'll probably mean that we have some completely different understanding of reality than we have right now. I think there's some aspects to this that only we'd be able to even scratch the surface of understanding.
Well. Again, your book really is a fascinating, very informative read. Now, if we could go to the levels of anomalies, you present a really interesting scale as to anomalies or anomalous events. I find that information very helpful. It will be helpful to all researchers. Again, you feel that these anomalies speak to that factor of physical mental duality. First of all, small anomalies, which entails some aspect.
Okay, yeah. I'm trying to remember back that far now.
Well, let me just quickly, your definition, small, now, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the reality paradoxes, kind of the reality shift. Then you get the small anomalies, and where basically some little thing in the world seems wrong. I have in the book, Evelyn is kind of one of the stars, if you will, of the cosmic bridge. She had, coming back from an encounter, she stood in the window waving, and she remembered the window being open and waving as this light dipped up and vanished into the sky. And later on, you know, when we looked at it, we realized that window doesn't open. And it's sort of like this, you know, kind of this colored, you know, kind of sort of this misremembered, you know, aspect of it. And then there's the larger, you know, kind of the larger anomalies where it's like the world seems wrong. Jenny Randall's coined it as the Oz factor.
Right.
It's pretty much the same aspects of it where the world suddenly changes. You're still in this world, but there's some aspects of it that seem to change. Like everything gets totally silent. The lighting characteristics of the world will change. Usually it's just everything becomes extremely silent. And then you get the spontaneous invisibility and several other things like that just seem to, occur in it. And one couple that I interviewed the man, and I have that in the book too, where he was driving on I-94 into St. Paul from Wisconsin, and they suddenly were on a different road, and they're trying to figure out where they were. They pulled off. They decided they would get off the freeway and try to figure out where they were, and they were going to go over the bridge and turn around and try and get back the interstate. And they pulled off, and he described the world around him as sort of being like an unfinished stage set.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The way he put it, it was God forgot to finish the world right here. And it looks sort of like, you can imagine, as like a Western town movie set, you know, all there are is the building fronts. And then they got to the top of the entrance or the exit ramp, and they were going to go over the bridge, and then all of a sudden the car stalled out at the top of the bridge. And he remembers thinking, must be the spark plugs again. And, he said, think about it. I've never had spark plug problems, and why would I have thought that?
Right.
And he got out of the car, he popped the hood, he got out of the car, and then the next thing he remembers is that they were away. They were back on I-94 heading into St. Paul. It was a couple hours later, and they were in just about the same spot where they last remembered being, before they ended up in this weird spot. And Bud had a whole bunch of cases like that where you ended up where people describe themselves in this sort of this anomalous, half-real, half-dream-ish sort of world. And then, you know, and then suddenly they're inside, then they're in the phenomenal realm. It seems to be sort of this transition stage in a way. Kind of this enter to or exit from the close encounter scenario.
Boy, that's well described. And I note here in your book, you indicate the full reality transformation.
That's where the rubber hits the road. You know, that's where, like Jacques, that's quote from Jacques Vallée, actually, where he described any kind of an event of the fourth kind. It's really a reality, a transformation of your personal reality. You know, you're seeing the flying saucer or the UFO or whatever it is from the inside, not from the outside. And you are now part of the phenomenon. You are within the domain of the phenomenon. Whatever's going on, you're now part of it. And so that's how people, and so that's that reality transformation. And there's a lot of other, there's a lot of other anomalies that occur that also involve reality transformations. Things like out-of-body experiences or astral projections, different things like that that appear, that seem to be just these where your reality changes.
Yes, and you do reference them. Very intriguing information there, concepts. Now, Craig, I definitely put this down in a note form for me to understand it fully. And, well, no, because, you know, I'm an older person, but I love reading about quantum material. And mm-hmm. you note that regarding phenomena, including spontaneous invisibility, you do discuss in your books and summarize such concepts as, quote, quantum holographic model, end quote,
yeah.
as depicted in Michael Talbot's book, The Holographic Universe.
And yeah.
interesting information there.
Yeah, my... Edgar Mitchell has some good information on that on his site. It's called the Nature's Mind, the Quantum Hologram. It's a he builds a pretty good model. You know, I don't begin to understand a lot of it, but what it is he basically looks at the world as basically a hologram. And based on, you know, everything is made up of quantum particles and all assembled into a meso or macroscopic realm that pretty much is, you know, functions in the classical manner. But down underneath at the smallest level, it's really an assemblage of these little quantum fields, you know, basically the size of an atom or smaller. And so what it amounts to is that when a quantum element of some kind really doesn't exist unless it's perceived by consciousness. And so effectively what happens is that there is essentially a perception of an object in the outside world is really a closed loop. There's a perception, there's an intention, and then there's a perception. And then there's what he calls adaptive resonance that occurs between the mind and the object that's being perceived in the outside world. And so what might be happening in something like spontaneous invisibility is that somehow this closed loop is being disrupted. And how, I have no idea, but yeah. I only begin to dimly understand this stuff, if at all. this is like super PhD level mathematics that I can't even begin to figure that out.
Well, you know, Craig, I found your book so interesting. You've really beautifully summarized.
Well, thank you.
This quantum research, and here I have to just briefly describe it. You also had noted the research of Penrose and Hameroff, and as you describe it in your book, that the human nervous system provides a coherent quantum medium with nerve cells possessing structures called microtubules.
Yeah.
Thank you. Composed of tubulins or protein building blocks in which the quantum properties emerge. That is really outstanding. And you also You also know, too, that the information in the brain is stored non-locally, but you notice such, you know, you have several, you, for example, you have Michael Talbot, additional information on that, but also Carl Pribram, who is responsible for research on mapping the brain's functional regions. There are two really cool points here. You note that the brain signals for retrieval as well as the storage process entails patterns of neural stimuli, and you're wondering if possibly an alien implant could have purpose and functions related to retrieving this information or perhaps influencing it.
That's a, you know, that's some intriguing possibilities there, because several of the implants that Dr. Lear have removed.
Yes.
And several other, you know, number of other researchers have looked at these things, and they don't appear to have any they're not like electronic chips. They appear to be, you know, if they're actually anomalous at all, and some of them have turned out to be, they think they're, you know, some of them are prosaic, like a piece of glass that got stuck in, you know, within the person's body, but others of them seem to be pretty anomalous, and most of these seem to be, at least as of the time when I wrote this, it appeared to be that they were this, there's an organic sheath around it there that seems to be biocompatible with the person whose body it's in, and then within it there's kind of an undifferentiated magnetic material, unmagnetized but magnetic material. And there's a lot of mathematics that goes into that, but the upshot is that it's a quantum, there's sort of a macro quantum, you know, properties to it that, what you tend to wonder is if this could actually be somehow a quantum computer, if you will, that's connected up to the ultimate quantum computer of the nervous system. And so it's a good, there's a lot of, it's, again, it just begins to ask those questions. I don't even begin, this is, it's, I'm not a quantum physicist by any means, so it's, I can hardly even begin to ask, phrase the question, much less find the answer. So anyway, so it gives you a real feeling of, you're just scratching the surface or just touching the tip of the iceberg.
And, you know, Craig, I think you've really touched upon the important points here. I even had a researcher specifically say to me today that he thinks that the aliens are interested in the nervous system and the brain. And you really brilliantly conjecture here that an alien device could possibly be able to interface with the quantum field which permeates the nervous system and possibly link into the individual's psychic ability as well.
A lot of the experiencers describe extremely enhanced psychic abilities that seem to go with these, with having an implant. A number of people several people who've described having, when they had implants removed, it's like their psychic abilities went away. There were several cases, about 10 years ago, I think, and if I could actually, you know, find the material or the reference for that, but there is something out there on that. Where when the implant was removed, it's like their psychic abilities vanished, or at least significantly reduced. And it's almost like they're seeing the world in two dimensions suddenly instead of three. So I'm beginning to think that there is some kind of bidirectional process going on there where the implant acts as part of the, as part of the experiencer's abilities, as well as some kind of a monitoring device. You know, we don't know what the function of this stuff is, but that's a pretty good speculation.
Boy, those are interesting comments. And, you know, Craig, there's one, I'm, of course, with all the case accounts, you use pseudonyms to hide the identity,
to protect
the privacy of your clients.
Yeah.
This fellow you named in your book, you just gave him the name, I think it was Jim, he was seeing a cartoon character, and he remembered just all positive recollections, mm-hmm. memories, but then when you regressed him, there was a duality there, some good moments, some not-so-good moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I initially give talks at sci-fi conventions a lot, because, you know, one of the reasons is that a lot of experiencers tend to gravitate towards science fiction as a way of coming to terms with the weird things that have gone on in their lives.
Yes.
So I was giving a talk at a sci-fi con, and Jim came up to me after my talk, and we sat down in the lobby of their, kind of back in the back corner of the lobby of the hotel, and he started he wanted to tell me all about his space brothers, if you will, kind of these real positive events in his life. But as he was telling me this, you could see the fear in his eyes. You know, like his, you know, enlightened space brothers were terrifying. And when I realized later on, I did regression work with him, and it was not as pretty as he would have you believe. He was pretty frightened by the whole thing when you look under the surface. So what I tend to wonder is, if someone says everything is all sweetness and light, I tend to think, no, really. If someone says that they're all evil, well, probably not. There seems to be kind of a mixed bag character to it. And so I tend to kind of want to transcend that polarity of good and evil and good and bad and things like that, and begin to look at, well, what's going on there from a kind of a transcendent picture, if you will.
Well, can I also ask two additional questions on that, Craig? And thank you for that information. Number one, when he probably went to reference that screen memory image, the cartoon character.
Well, the cartoon character, yeah, right. Yeah.
Was he initially seeing that in sort of a two-dimensional format?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the format was that he saw. And a lot of the times, the memory is actually quite indistinct. If you start looking at the memory, and it's a childhood memory, you know how stylized, you know, any of your memories are from childhood.
Right.
You know, like when you're a little kid, some of your first memories tend to be kind of a cartoonish in a way.
Yes.
Tend to be stylized, tend to be kind of symbolic. And when this little guy was about the same, this little cartoon character was about the same. It's hard to tell whether, you know, how many dimensions it had, two or three or, you know, 105 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed, when you look at these things, when you look at the memory closer, you know, when you ask, like, what color are, you know, Bozo's eyes? You know, say Bozo
right.
the Clown, for example. What color are Bozo's eyes? You know, well, black. You know, what color is Bozo's hair? Well, he doesn't have any hair. What color are the, you know, and anytime you examine screen memories, they tend to dissolve into what they're screening. So that's pretty, there's a lot of, they don't stand up to scrutiny much, let's put it that way.
Thank you for that information. And, you know, Craig, are you finding with your case accounts that the grays predominate in the abduction accounts?
I would say largely yes. They seem to be sort of the worker bees, if you will. Pretty much everybody's described, you know, having at least some experiences with grays. I don't know if it's everybody has had them or if just people have had them, but largely, you know, a few people describe humanoid-type beings, but mostly it's small grays that seem to do the, you know, the capture and return, you know, your phenomena. And then there tends to be a tall gray would be called, like, the doctor or the leader or the captain or something like that. That seems to be one of the sort of the next level up of functionaries, if you will. And then above that, there seems to be some other being that's calling the shots, pulling the strings, if you will. I've heard a number of different descriptions of, like, reptilians or mantises or humanoids of some kind. A lot of different descriptions of that. Things get a little varied when you start talking about that second, third level removed. But it seems to be, grays seem to be the front, you know, kind of the cutting edge, if you will.
Thank you for that answer. That's very helpful. And, you know, Craig, as material, you know useful and important suggestions for those observing UFOs and even encountering ETs in contact situations. Those, to me, really seemed very helpful. First of all...
I've got an article in there called What to Do.
Yes. First, you advise the individual to remain calm and stay objective.
Yeah, right. I always wonder what I do if I saw. I've never actually had an up close and personal sighting, but I always wonder, you know, if I were actually in that situation, would I remain as calm as I'm? You know, would I practice what I preach?
Well, you know, before we continue, a very quick question. This just came to mind now. There's a very famous experiencer now who gives accounts of actually being in traffic and seeing a UFO, a large UFO, hovering in close proximity over his car. Are the people in traffic advised to observe it if they are seeing it, but not overly concentrate on it, to not themselves get become part of the action, so to speak?
Well, you don't want to be part of the abductee club. You know, it's not something, you know, like Bud Hopp, the way Bud Hopp, this is not a club that anybody wants to join. This is, you know, it's not a pleasant experience. It's very traumatic. It's like totally disruptive of your life. So in that sense, you know, if you see something up close, don't make it up close and personal. Just, you know, observe and try and stay unobserved as best you can. That's the way I put it.
You do, and you do a wonderful job. You were mentioning on that type of close encounter or CE3 event where the beings are seen, they're observed. You do know it's wise for the observer to not flee or approach in order to not unduly attract their attention.
Stay as inconspicuous as you can, basically. Mm-hmm. If you see something, there's a lot of these that occurred in this, a lot of these events that occurred in the 60s and 70s, or 50s through 70s, where there's a lot of, you know, APRO and KUFOS all have these file drawers bulging with these cases of entity reports or of occupant reports that, you know, we haven't seen as many of them since the 70s. You know, it's taken a much more active, kind of a much more interactive role since the 70s, but in the 70s there were a lot of these occupant reports that were in the APRO files that tended to be, you know, people would see them and they would accidentally or get curious or something like that, or either that or they'd get scared and try and run away. And so there would be these cases where the beings would observe the witness and then capture them or something like that, or interact in some way with them, and the result is usually not all that positive. And then there was like the Falcon Lake encounter in 65, I think it was, where there's a prospector who was, you know, up in Falcon Lake, Ontario, was doing prospecting for uranium. And he came across these two UFOs that were, one of them was landed, it looked like it was having troubles, and he walked up to it, and there was suddenly this blast of heat, and it came out from the thing, and it actually ignited his flannel shirt on fire, and then the thing was lifting off, is like sort of like almost like getting caught in rocket exhaust or something like that. It's like basically.
Yes.
Really, you know, basically the guy was very badly injured, you know, had significant burns on his chest, and he was in Mayo Clinic, and there's all kinds, it's a very well-documented case, but Jacques Vallée has a whole catalog of these things where his point being is that UFOs are dangerous. Don't get too close, we don't know what we're dealing with, so... the best thing to do is stay at a discreet distance, observe everything you can, and try and stay as calm as possible. Again, I always say, I've never had a really close sighting myself, so I was kind of wonder, would I practice what I preach here? Or you just don't know. It's, you know, until you've been in that situation, it's really hard. It's hard to imagine what it would be like, though.
Well, the advice sounds very pragmatic. And one of our favorite researchers, Lily from New York.
Hello?
Out of that truck. Oh, what a wonderful case account he has. It's a beautifully described, transparent case. He passed those polygraph tests, and he's just a very strong witness and advocate for the field. And back to your advice, your items there that the observer should keep in mind to note as many details as possible, time, location, and condition.
That's probably the biggest thing. The more you can notice, the better off, it's going to be for researchers later. The more you can provide to humanity, if you will. Effectively, you are the only scientific instrument in the place at the moment. So, basically, the more you can observe and notice, the better off as far as subsequent investigation.
Very well said. And, Craig, you do suggest that the experiencer of a CE4 consider reporting the event to a trusted individual and, if possible, mm-hmm. to a research organization. And, of course, the individual can feel free to demand anonymity or confidentiality of his or her account.
Yeah.
Those confidentiality agreements, non-disclosure agreements, great idea. If someone had a horrid, promoting such an objective focus here, but let's say someone does have a traumatic event. He believes he's been abducted, he or she has been abducted. Mm-hmm. What are good tips if they should approach an individual for example, a hypnotherapist to discuss this matter as to being advised whether or not that specialist or family member or colleague would be open to the ET subject? Just common markers?
What I would do, I wouldn't broach, I always put up, there's 23 letters in the alphabet. They don't include U, F, and O. What I would do is just drop little hints about the subject, a little bitty suggestion, and see what the person's reaction is. I do this in general, in casual conversation with people all the time. Where you drop these little tidbits into the conversation, see people's reactions. If they seem open to the topic, then you can maybe feed out a little more. But if they don't, then drop the subject. I mean, basically, giving someone an earful about having been abducted by aliens, if they don't have any acceptance or belief in the possibility of this being true, would just make two people with shattered reality instead of just one. So what I would do, what I tend to do in conversation is then I'll make some comments about something about light in the sky or something like that, and just see the person's reaction. If they seem interested, then you can carry a little further. But basically, it's sort of like testing the waters. You kind of, stick your toe in first, then you stick your whole foot in, and then eventually you're up to your waist, and then you dive in. But I would not just dive in head first into waters you don't know.
That's superb advice. And who knows, the other person, your family member or colleague, mm-hmm. might he or she, himself or herself, be an experiencer and not have come to terms with it themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I know a number of hypnotherapists that wouldn't touch, wouldn't encounter work with a 10-foot pole. And so I tend to get referrals from people out there like that. And then there's a number of, if you go into the mainstream psychology community, they'll want to cure you of your delusions. So you have to be very careful about how much you're willing to trust with people, how much you're willing to tell people. And one of the things that I do, and of course I have to add the caveat here too, that I work with the medical community. I'm a complementary or integrative, medical or health worker. Work with, a healer. I'm not an alternative. I'm a complementary healer. So if you have medical issues, anything, even psychological issues that seem to be, even if they come from something where you, even if they come from something you wouldn't necessarily want to tell, your doctor about that you think you were, quote-unquote kidnapped by space aliens, if you will, you can still tell them that you think you were injured somehow. Something, not quite sure what happened, but something occurred. There was one lady who called me up, and she was terrified. Her toe was injured somehow. And she had no idea how, but it felt like her toe had been injured. And she had vague memories of it occurring during a close encounter. And there's a lot more to the story that I'm not saying, but finally I asked her, have you tried talking to a doctor and things like that? I said, well, I wouldn't know what to say. Well, just say that you think you injured your toe. You don't have to tell them why you think it, or what the circumstances were. Just tell her that you're not sure, or tell the doctor that you think, you're not sure how it happened, but you think there's something wrong with your toe, or somehow your toe was injured, and just take it from there to see what happens.
Boy, that's excellent advice. Well, Craig, this first hour has gone very, very quickly. We'll take about a 10-minute break now, but I hope you can return for the second hour. I find this so informative, and I just want to let everyone know again, Craig's excellent research and books can be referenced at his website, www.craig.lang.com.
So there's also, I also have a website, the other website for the Cosmic Bridge is www.thecosmicbridge.com.
Excellent. That's very helpful.
Sure. I didn't see that in the bio there, but that's I just thought about it now. Is you can find the cosmicbridge.com is talks specifically about the book, and craigrlang.com is about my hypnotherapy practice and some other of my anomaly research.
That's very, very helpful, and I'll add that also to the bio at globalfocus.com. Well, I'll see you back in 10. Boy, I'm excited. And we'll just remain on the line, but I'll go to get my beverage and probably some cookies, whatever, a little snack. I do love to snack.
I'll just leave it off the book then.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, okay. Craig. Can't wait to start the second segment. Bye-bye.
See you in 10.
We'll be right back. Thanks.
You can catch us every Saturday, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current news and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can always catch it here, News on the Flip Side. Only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about psychic readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you the way the spirits give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month, Insight, 11 to midnight.
Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Craig Lang, a certified hypnotherapist, NLP practitioner, researcher, writer, healer. Craig's website can be found at www.craigrlang.com. Welcome back, everyone, and I'd like to add an additional website there for Craig Lang's research and books, that being www.thecosmicbridge.com, and of course the other website is www.craigrlang.com. Excellent books, superb research. And before I learned several new facts and aspects on the research and findings. I found it personally very, very helpful, and I know our audience is very much appreciating this interview and definitely would appreciate reading your books as well. And before we return to a really great interview, I'm learning a lot, that's for sure, I just want to very quickly note that at this point I just mentioned to our listeners the wonderful shows on the network. They include UFO Undercover Wednesday evenings with host Joe Montaldo, Saturday evenings News on the Flip Side with Stephanie Benetti and Joe Montaldo. Great new show, starts at 8 p.m. Eastern. I say that despite being the fact that, of course, this I'm speaking from an Obama, President Obama household. Now, let's see here. On Friday evenings before the show, we have Karen Dolan. Great show, Through the Keyhole, with host Karen Dolan, excellent researcher and conference speaker. Now, let's see here. We have Monday, on Monday evenings, Mind Cemetery with Chip and Nicole Plesher. And also on Saturdays, we have Voice of the People before News on the Flip Side and Church of Mavis directly afterwards. Miss those shows. They're very intriguing, very engaging. Now, let's get back to this great interview, and I hope this question isn't annoying, but I'm dying to ask it. That being, Craig, in your regression accounts, have there been indications that any of your clients have experienced my lab accounts? My lab experiences, rather. Everyone, if I'm still on, I think we might have just lost Craig. We'll be right back with our guest, Craig R. Lang.
The unknown. Do you constantly watch the sky, wondering if there's something out there? In fear of things going bump in the night.
This Freak Radio brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. This is Second Sight.
Craig Lang, a certified hypnotherapist, NLP practitioner, researcher, writer, and healer. Craig's website can be found at www.craigrlang.com. Welcome back, everyone. We had a problem there with the phone connection. It was just a momentary one. And my question had been if Craig, in his regressions or research, had ever found any allusions or any references to the My Lab phenomenon. And I just asked him now as we got back on. I don't think he has. Of course, it's a phenomenon that only some people know about. And I must say, Craig's research and findings extend elsewhere to a great full spectrum of the different contactee cases. Now, my question to you is, and Craig, I'm correct on that. You really haven't heard about My Labs in your particular regression.
I haven't heard specifically about them, per se. People haven't come forward to me to say that. What I have found is that in some cases, people have described humanoid beings in the phenomenal realm, some of which appeared to be in military uniforms. Whether that's a screen memory or whether that's whether they actually are military personnel, I can't honestly say. Evelyn describes having been on one side of a walking down a hallway, and on the other side she saw non-human beings plus what appeared to be military personnel again. So it's not at all clear to me what's actual or whether there's kind of screen memories associated with it.
Well, thank you very much for that answer. And now, Craig, before we discuss the different models that you discuss concerning ET contact, Craig, you do describe that in your work, this must be generally, since the human mind is composed of many parts or ego states.
Yeah. Right.
With their own feelings, as you note, with their own feelings, thoughts, complexes, ideas, and memories, they produce the fabric of consciousness, and that through deep hypnosis, the therapist can address the various individual parts for issue resolution.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very common part of hypnotherapy, is what's called parts work, or parts, in psychology terms, it's called ego state therapy, and in hypnotherapy parlance is called parts mediation, where you basically you can talk with individual parts of a person's consciousness by inviting a person, inviting a part to come out, and like I would say, ask me, I wonder if I could speak to the part of Therese that believes or that tells or that knows how is protecting her from, something like among us that helps her to feel the uneasy feeling she feels around spiders, for example. And I would get in deep trance a part of the mind, kind of an amorphous little section of the mind that's really nucleated around the memory, the negative memories of a spider, for example. And other aspects of it. And so what I did with Evelyn, for example, was I invited the part of Evelyn that helps her to feel the way she feels when she's, she feels right now. And, you frame it in kind of a positive term. Basically, you're trying to get the person to come out and talk. It's like family therapy in a way, or family mediation. And you want to build rapport with all of the parts, and you can almost treat them like individual people in a way, in deep trance. And so then you can mediate between them. It's almost like a, like I say, mediation service, if you will.
Boy, that's interesting information. You're like a true expert in your work, and
well, I hope so.
I would say it sounds to me like your clients are very fortunate people, and
Well, thank you.
I have never had hypnotherapy, but boy, it sounds like really a wonderful modality, a great modality.
Powerful.
Yes, it certainly sounds it, and very well worth pursuing. Now, Craig, here at this point, I'd like to discuss the possibilities you note from your research findings as to ET motivations regarding Earth and contact with humans. You discuss a number of really interesting models. Now, first, you describe in detail Dr. James Deardorff's theories presented in his article, quote, a possible extraterrestrial strategy for Earth, end quote.
Yeah.
And now, Dr. Deardorff's model entails a series of incremental steps for contact.
Yeah.
And the contact measures by the aliens are covert ones. You note that the evolving contact would begin with an initial observation of humans, then the commencement of a limited contact program. However, interaction would occur within the populace without control by human authorities, but at some point the aliens might want to covertly contact human authorities. Do you think Deardorff's model still retains a paradigm that is plausible for you?
I think it's a good model for a lot of what we see. There seems to be this unfolding phenomenon that began probably prior to World War II, that there was a kind of a cat and mouse, if you will, kind of very, you know, sort of like the hunters hunting in a, or hiding in a duck blind or something like that, or anthropologists observing animals or primitive civilizations or whatever in, you know, like Jane Goodall's chimpanzee research, where she largely initially stayed out of sight of the chimpanzees initially, and only later on did she actually, you know, form a relationship with the chimpanzees themselves. So what it seems to be, at least initially, that there would be kind of a covert observation, kind of maybe since at first, and then gradually, once data was acquired, or a lot of data was acquired, and a significant understanding of the overall lay of the land, if you will, then there might be kind of this covert contact or abduction, if you will. And yet there, you know, this is just an approximation. One thing you can be sure about aliens is that they'd be alien. I think that's Carl Sagan, a quote from Carl Sagan. But this is at best an approximation of reality. So, and I think we have to be very careful about that.
Well, you know, Craig, too, and thank you for that information, for that insight. You know, your particular model, your nature preserve model, offers several plausible explanations for the alien contact phenomenon. Under that paradigm, you know, the aliens here. More or less just representing what you said, hopefully correctly. Under your nature preserve model, you note the aliens would be attempting to observe through scientific study the inhabitants and ecology of the preserve, and you note that terrestrial life would be studied and managed under that nature preserve.
Yeah. So, yeah, it would be, you can imagine sort of a ranger animal model or metaphor. Or another one would be kind of scientist lab animal model. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine that there might be, you know, periodically the rangers will fly in and abduct the wolf, quote unquote, and they'll put a radio collar implant, quote unquote, on the wolf. And if that wolf could talk, it would have one hell of a story to tell after all that was done. So.
Yes.
Yeah, you can imagine sort of an analogy there. You know, I'm sure it has its limitations, but there's a lot of understanding to be gleaned from that.
Indeed. And, Craig, here I just would like to interject a question, and that is just my thought that could it be true that possible that some aliens might have self-interested motives, such as protecting the Earth with its resources, whether water and mineral resources or tremendous biological diversity or human biological resources for their own purposes?
Yeah, we don't know why they're here. There's a lot of speculation, some positive, some very decidedly non-positive. Marshall V. and Sumner's has some very non-positive views. David Jacobs is even more non-positive about it. You know, his book, The Threat, you want to have about a month's worth of Prozac after you read that. Some of the scenarios are painted are just not pretty. And to some extent, they seem to have some experiential evidence to back them up. Bud Hopkins had had some pretty interesting and kind of dark stuff in his case files, and David Jacobs does too. So there, you know, there is some rather non-positive stuff there, but at the same time, is it really dark, or is it just that we see it as dark? You know, it's hard to know. And like I say, we don't really know what they're doing, and we don't really begin to understand it.
Very intriguing comments. And before I note a great question from our New York Lily, there is another model you present as well. And as you referenced, the Dr. David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins hybridization program is definitely, per their reports, rather a negatively presented or a negative scenario, let's say.
Yeah.
But also, you have a counter one, a strongly counter one, countering one, rather, the Human Improvement Project, wherein you suggest that perhaps some ETs would like to acclimate us to the world of cosmic interaction.
Yeah, well, it's another possibility. You know, it's like I have no idea whether it's any more true than any other. You know, it's pure speculative at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But look at it from the point of view of our neighbors, for example. You know, if you look at the line item on sort of the world budget, if you will, some incredibly high percentage of that is devoted to killing each other. You know, basically war is our biggest single line item in the world budget, if you will. And so if I were the neighbors, I'd be a little concerned about the idea of these other than perfectly civilized beings spilling out into the galaxy. And I don't think we're that far away from developing a workable star travel, maybe a few 100, 200, 300 years, 400, something like that. Probably, I think the way our physics is advancing right now, probably we could conceivably have a working star travel in a few hundred years. And if I were the neighbors, I'd be a little worried about that. So perhaps, and again, this is purely a perhaps, this is purely speculative, but maybe that's kind of the motivator for why the phenomenon seems to have accelerated since World War II. World War II advanced us in a lot, or caused technology to advance tremendously, like nuclear technology probably advanced 100 years in the space of about 5 years.
Yes.
So I would, you know, and then we started experimenting with rockets on a big way, and then we ended up with multi-tons of explosives pointing at each other, and these same powers that have nuclear missiles pointed at each other were also busy shooting rockets up into space and heavily involved in space exploration. And you look at it now, to the nations that are heavily involved in space exploration now, basically the U.S., Europe, and China, also have very large military programs, so the two are, you know, inextricably bound together. And from the visitor's point of view, that's probably not a good thing. It's, you know, it's basically, Stephen Greer talks a lot about the militarization of space, and Alfred Weber and a number of the other disclosure project types talk a lot about the militarization of space, and that we are, you know, basically, if you go back to the paradigm of, you know, the day of the Earth stood still, I think that movie is so prescient in that it broaches, one of the first one to broach the idea that the, and I'm talking about the old 1952 movie,
right,
was one of the first ones to broach the idea that, you know, that maybe our taking the military weaponry into space, into the universe, wouldn't be perceived very highly. So maybe that would be one way of, maybe that the visitors, whoever they are, and there's probably a lot more than one group of visitors visiting us, but you could think of that some kind of an orchestrated effort to prevent this from, maybe somehow, instead, you know, you could do one of two things. One is prevent these wild and wily humans from spilling out into space. Or the other is you could send them out, you know, improve them in such a way that when they do get out into space, they are more aware and more conscious and basically more civilized, better neighbors, you know. So those are two possibilities. And so one thing that I ask is, might there be some kind of a human improvement project underway that might be you know, somehow trying to, you know, breed a little couth into us, if you will.
Thank you for that explanation. Those comments are very intriguing. You have some really very intriguing, very.
It's a lot more positive. It's a lot more positive than David Jacobs' scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, it is. And I have a further question here from New York Lily. Excellent question, Craig. She wants to know if you've heard anything recently. Again, this is from New York Lily. Have you heard anything recently, Craig, from the experiencers? Those would be the people who consult you in your practice that might show a pattern and could indicate where these experiences are headed.
I don't think, at least in my view. I think Joel and Linda Montaldo have a considerably bigger database than I do. Bud Hopkins had one Bud Hopkins and Jed Turnbull and several others have worked with probably five to ten times as many experiencers as I have over their careers. They may have a better sample size than I do. I haven't seen a lot to indicate what the alien agenda would be or what the statistical trends are. What we do tend to find is distinct trends in the physical descriptions of UFOs. We tend to find distinct trends in the descriptions of the beings themselves. And there seems to be a lot of description of trends in the interaction, but what's the fundamental, you know, is that kind of a sample bias or kind of a, you know, statistical anomaly, or is it an actual trend? I really don't know.
Well, very thoughtful answer, though. Thank you. Now, Craig, your material also discusses the awakening concept, whereby an individual, after contact, or, as you note, after a life-altering event, such as a near-death experience or other major event, perceives his or her life with a new focus. This change can indeed be sudden and dramatic. Your thoughts on the awakening?
Well, it seems, you know, it's pretty much... it's any kind of a real kind of earth-shaking or reality-shaking event will do that to you. I mean, basically, nothing can wake you up more than some kind of really powerful, and one of them is abduction by aliens. That's one of the, I can't think of too much more earth-shaking than that. But cancer survivors describe these kind of enlightenment experiences, near NDE survivors describe that. A lot of people have these, you know, you're my God to the events that, you know, that just takes the fabric of your reality and just shakes it, you know, it kind of takes the rug of your reality and shakes it. And so what I tend to find is that close encounters are just one of those things, just one of those classes of experiences.
Thank you. No, that's very intriguing. And also, you know, I like the way you put, or you suggested, that the phenomenon of the awakening can sometimes be the precursor to ET contact or the aftermath, the result.
Yeah, there's a big chicken and egg question there. Do experiences predispose someone to be a contactee or abductee, or does abduction itself or close encounter activity tend to aggravate or accelerate some kind of a paranormal or metaphysical awakening or kind of a psychic awakening? That it's not real clear to me what's the case, but when I look at some of the family lines of experiencers, I've tended to find that it seems to go down, at least to some degree, down the maternal family line, grandma to mom to the female experiencer, and then her kids, typically her daughter. daughter, one or more daughters, would be heavily involved in the phenomenon, which tends to suggest that there, well, it tends to suggest that there's that predisposition, you know, in, among the family line. But when you look back at it, you see, well, mom was a psychic, grandma was a healer back in the old country, that sort of thing.
Right.
So you tend to find this, you tend to find this run of gifts, if you will, in that family line. So whether, you know, whether that's which is which, I don't know. Graham Hancock has a pretty good book out that I read a while ago, long since I published Bridge, was called Supernatural, where he takes that question, you know, in, you know, a little bit of his book, it's only about a chapter of it, takes that question head on, and he claims that, or suggests anyway, that maybe the, at least a large component of the UFO abduction phenomenon is really shamanic in nature. It's not, there's not physical alien craft at all. It's really more of a shamanic experience. So it's, there's so much to chew on there. I don't know yet.
Yes, it is very intriguing information. Also, Craig, I know ICAR has found, this would be an ICAR research finding, that there can be one ET, for example, one gray, who has been interacting with family members sequentially over a series of generations. Have you found that, you know, one gray interacting with the grandmother, then mother, then daughter?
I haven't noticed that particularly. It's very hard. You know, most of the people describe, the individuals will describe having contact with a specific handler, if you will, kind of a specific, mm-hmm. like the captain or the leader or something like that. But I haven't seen where that's crossed multiple generations. But the only reason I haven't seen it is because I haven't had that data. I haven't really looked for it, frankly, actually. So that,
right.
that's an interesting. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting little point there. Joe and Linda seem to have had, they've done a lot of amazing research in this area that,
yes.
You know, my hat goes off to them. They've done some amazing stuff there. You know, and I think a lot of, you know, I'd love to replicate some of their studies, you know, to see, you know, what the, you know, to see, you know, do I pick up the same thing? There's a lot of pretty good statistical research in there that, you know, I think it's a really nice stab in the right direction. So, you know, like I say, my hats go off to them for that.
Well said. Now, Craig, this is something I learned, another aspect that I learned from your book, and that is, you note an interesting finding of yours that some psychically gifted individuals can perceive UFOs and not be experiencers, and you term individuals, quote, perceivers, end quote.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, there seems to be that case. There's been, I've seen a number of cases where I don't think the person is an abductee, but they've seen the UFO and other people have not. There is a sort of the selective viewability. I think it's kind of the flip side of the spontaneous invisibility, where, except where the UFO is selectively visible rather than the human being. But the, but some people can see through the cloaking device, if you will. And so there seems to be that ability to, you know, this seems to be that ability, that psychic ability. A lot of people who are very gifted seers have a lot of UFO sightings, but I don't necessarily think they're all abductees. So they're, you know, I've done regressions with a few of them, and I've seen they've had metaphysical experiences that, to the best of my knowledge, were not ufological. I think they were purely metaphysical or shamanic experiences. I don't believe, or I don't sense that they were close encounter experience, UFO experiences.
That's a very interesting point. Would that make possible in the scenario, and I think I'm probably just paraphrasing what you've just said, a very gifted psychic might perceive the presence of an ET and not be himself or herself a psychic, an experiencer?
Yeah, right. That's entirely possible, I think. I've seen a number of, well, I would say they're not be an abductee. Everybody's an experiencer in the, you know, by virtue of the fact that they're having some kind of an unusual experience.
Right.
Well, it's entirely possible that it's like a contact experience, or maybe just a, you know, a event of a third kind where you observe something, but you're not actually interacting with the phenomenon. I think there are a number of those cases that that are in the literature, and I've seen a few of them myself. I've worked with a few of them myself, where the experiencer, you know, the client describes having, when I have them in trance, they describe having these sightings, these experiences, but they don't seem to go aboard the visitors into the alien realm, if you will. They don't seem to be undergoing an abduction experience. They just seem to be observing, if you will.
Well, you know, that I find that very intriguing, also very helpful. So in other words, in your terminology, experiencer will be someone who has capability or has simply had these anomalous events or observed them in his life,
yeah,
and could be either a psychic or an abductee or contactee,
yeah,
but it could be all three categories. That's interesting.
There's kind of a fuzzy boundary between experiencer and perceiver and
mm-hmm.
things like that. You know, it's hard to draw a sharp line there. Sometimes an experiencer, a perceiver can have some kind of an experience, like maybe an out-of-body experience or a lucid dream or astral projection or something, remote view or something like that. You could say is an anomaly of the fourth kind. You know, it's not necessarily a close encounter of the fourth kind. It's not an alien abduction, but it is that reality transformation anyway. You know, shamanic experiences are like that. It's an event of the fourth kind in that there's this reality transformation, but it's not an alien abduction per se. So there's a lot of gray, if you will, or shades of fuzziness, that seem to grade into or between paranormal and metaphysical and ufological there.
Well, you know, before I turn to another subject, again, that information is very thought-provoking. We have one of our great researchers, Jofa, mentioning the quality of being unusually empathic. And I'm thinking here, if I remember correctly, that term for interpersonal intelligence, heightened awareness of others, including heightened empathy. So that's really very, very intriguing.
Yeah, a lot of indigo children, a lot of indigo and crystal children now describe, you know, in this generation of children appear to be in that description, very empathic, able to pick up on other people's emotions and see other things from other people's point of view. Very gifted, like very high emotional intelligence scale.
Well, you know, this is a great point to discuss, transgenics and indigo children. You know,
yeah.
Craig, your work provides great summaries for researchers,
yeah,
and experiencers of the hybridization,
yeah,
program. Now,
yeah,
do the importance of transgenics, denoting the selection of genes to transmit the desired characteristics,
mm-hmm,
for placement, implantation into another genome.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Craig, on this type of genetic manipulation, you eloquently note that it could be the development of a new type of human. Craig, here is it a case of appreciating the heightened capabilities of an indigo child, or the evolution of man into, as researcher Mary Rodwell terms, Homo noeticus?
Yeah,
or is this a negative scenario? Does it suggest alien usurpation of the human birthright? What do you think?
I can't tell you that either one side or the other is wrong. You know,
mm-hmm,
it's one person's lemons and another person's lemonade. You know, how do you know? You know, it's, you know, one person's excrement is a fertilizer. You know, it's like, it's hard,
mm-hmm,
to tell. You know, it's almost a judgment call as to whether it's positive or non-positive. What I do tend to think is that, you know, it could be considered either way, depending on who you are, what your perspective is. I know a lot of people from the Christian fundamentalist point of view that think that this is, you know, purely demonic, and that this is like bringing in the end times and Armageddon and things like that. So, I mean, I don't see, you know, you can't get much more negative than that. But at the same time, I see people, Marshall Vian Summers and David Jacobs and a number of others that are real, Elaine Douglas, who really have a very dark view of the phenomenon. Basically, Elaine talks about the, basically the kind of a genetic or kind of a emotional exploitation or emotional subjugation of the experiencer, and others talk about like genetic exploitation. That's David Jacobs' theme in a nutshell, is that they are breeding a replacement for us. Kind of a there's a slow motion takeover, if you will, in progress. And I don't know if I buy that, but I don't know that they're wrong either. So, you know, like I said, to me, the jury is definitely out.
And, you know, you do very fairly note the results regarding indigo children abilities, that they reflect traits that would be considered very positive, highly empathic and intuitive, having visionary goals, excellent powers of intellect and perception. So those are positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're also, their characteristics, though, they don't necessarily say what the person's motivations are. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, a lot of the kids, there are a lot of the people that have done the really negative things, you know, like the shootings, things like that, you know, the theater shooting, and things like that, also tended to have some descriptions like that, tended to be very quiet, tended to be kind of empathic, tended to be, you know, there's a very, very bright children, and yet they turned into something really, you know, non-wonderful. So, you know, it's, you know, and I can't tell you that I haven't studied it enough to know whether any given person would be specifically an indigo child or something like that. But there's one, I think, Doreen Virtue and a couple of other of the people who've been, Jan Tolber and Lee Carroll have talked about this a lot, that the indigo children, if you will, tend to have this feeling of entitlement. And I don't know if that's kind of cultural, that's just been built into society, because that seems to be an endemic issue in our society right now anyway, is that there's a lot of sense of entitlement in certain areas, certain parts of the society. And I won't go into any further than that, because I'm probably pulling somebody's political strings here.
Uh-huh.
But having said that, though, one, I think it's Doreen Virtue talks about that the indigo children came in to pull down the old system, and then what she refers to as the crystal children are now coming in to build up the new. And I've heard that from a number of different sources that there seems to be this tearing down and building up. So it'd be interesting to see now over the next 10 years or so, as the current generation of children comes of age, what do we begin to see? Do we begin to see a whole new turn in kind of the political, social fabric of the Western world, or the world in general, or, you know, what? You know, I have no idea where this is going to go, but it's, you know, these are some hypotheses, if you will.
And, you know, on your paradigms and some of the research discussions, you always give that counter-argument. You note that regarding indigo children, they might have been affected by some type of genetic manipulation, but they also may be the result of natural evolution or even the interface with consecutive generations to alien contact.
Could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't know. You know, we don't know. I mean, any scientist worth their salt can really only offer a hypothesis and offer some possible ways of testing it. You have to ask, if the hypothesis is, what must we see for a hypothesis to be true?
Mm-hmm.
And what is it, you know, if this hypothesis is true, what does it imply? What is it that we can observe that would either confirm or deny that hypothesis? And so there are a number of things that I kind of wonder, and I wish I had the expertise to be able to do this, and maybe somebody out there who's listening could pick up the ball a little bit on this, is some kind of genetic markers or some kind of, you know, physiological characteristics that would distinguish like an indigo or a crystal child from a from other basically non-indigo crystal? And if what would be, and furthermore, is there something that would be characteristic to an experiencer, a population that we would arbitrarily define as being experiencers? Is there something in common that experiencers have that non-experiencers don't? And I think Joe and Linda Montaldo have been doing some excellent work in that area. It's not clear to me whether a real coherent picture has emerged, but maybe some differentiating characteristics might show up there. So I don't know. It's just something to it's some areas to look, you know, to train your microscope, if you will.
Excellent ideas. Now, Craig, in your work, you do present strong arguments as to the present state of non-disclosure on a formal basis by world authorities such as government elements. You do wisely suggest that some of these elements in power may have some, but not all, or even a comprehensible or fully functioning informational base on the aliens and the status of interaction with humans.
My guess is that they're not really players. They're trying to figure out, just like the rest of us are, they're trying to figure out what's going on. Basically the phenomenon does what it will, regardless of whatever government wants, and if you were looking at it from the point of view of the military, this would not be a particularly quieting, a particularly comforting feeling. You look at the military, it's the military's job to protect the sovereignty of the United States. And similarly, other nations' militaries, it's their job to protect the sovereignty of that nation, enhance the power of that nation and increase whatever they would do to improve the economic well-being. One of the things that the Air Force job is to protect our skies. Well, you get these little guys that can fly in whenever they choose, and really there's little or nothing that the military can really do about it. So basically, it would be from their point of view, it would be a very disquieting feeling to be in this position where there's this intelligent agency of some kind that's doing its business without any kind of influenceability, if you will, by the people who are supposed to be controlling our skies. So basically, in other words, they're sort of like not able to do their job because what they're up against is way beyond their capabilities. So from that point of view, it's like they're not even a factor. They want to be a factor, but they don't. But they're not really a factor. So they're almost irrelevant. And what contact is, whatever agenda is going to happen is going to happen regardless of whatever governmental agencies want.
Those are powerful points there, Craig. And that's the end of the program. My final question is, you do believe in the end that as far as disclosure is concerned, it will be revealed by the phenomenon itself and also that undeniable massive information now that perhaps is accumulating among the populace?
It's probably, my speculation would be kind of in keeping with that Deardorff model. Mm-hmm. It's probably going on bottom up. Disclosure is going to occur one person at a time, basically. One experiencer at a time, one contactee at a time. That's probably how disclosure is going to happen. I sincerely doubt that. I can't imagine Obama or, whoever's president, then at the time, Obama or Romney or whoever, whoever it is that's the president, standing up. I have an announcement to make. For 100 years now, we've been, aliens have been landing in our backyard and abducting our citizens, and not a damn thing we can do about it. Have a nice day. Vote for me for my reelection. I don't think so. So my own belief is that I can't picture full disclosure ever occurring to some degree, in a grand way by any kind of a human agency. Whether the visitors do their own disclosure is a whole other question. My own bet is that eventually the truth will be known by, but it will come bottom up rather than top down.
Very well said. And Craig, I want to thank you again for a wonderful interview. I also want to remind our audience that Craig's books and research can be accessed at www.craigrlang.com and www.thecosmicbridge.com. And final comment, I'd like you, for example, to take us out. Craig, people can contact you if they have questions
this
phenomenon, and also they would particularly like to have a client consultation with you and that great hypnotherapy modality.
The best way to get a hold of me is by email. It's craig@craigrlang.com. You can just click, go into my website, and there's the link right there. My phone number is on there and things like that, too. I'll give out my phone number here, 763-257-7334. Every time I do that, I get a few crank calls, but, I also get a lot of people who need an ear. So, I'll take that risk. But you can get a hold of me at, my 763-257-7334. Or you can get a hold of me through my website or by email at craig@craigrlang.com. And so I look forward to hearing from somebody here who feels like they have a story to tell.
Thank you again, Craig, and thank you so much for your services to the community. Very much appreciated.
Indeed,
thank you again, sir. And thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening. We wish you all a great weekend. Good night, everyone.
Take care.
Thank you again, Craig. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening on A Global Focus with guest Craig Lang. We appreciate your time with us on Fridays and wish you all a great weekend. Good night.